In the coming week, the U.S. Federal Reserve is poised to raise interest rates. The United States takes over the presidency of the U.N. Security Council, and Japan marks Constitution Day amid defense and security changes. It's April 28, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's kick off this week's show by discussing the May 3rd and May 4th meeting of the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee. It's expected that the Fed may aggressively raise interest rates in the coming weeks. But break all of this down for us, Bob. What's going on here and why is the Fed looking to jack up interest rates?
Jim, until most recently, we had been hearing the term transitory inflation coming from the Federal Reserve Chairman, Jay Powell, and a number of others in the sort of analytical community regarding the looming threat of inflation or not. That word's not being used anymore. It's pretty much confirmed or consensus that inflation is here to the tune of 8.5% inflation as registered by the Consumer Price Index between March 2021 and 2022. There was a raise of 0.25% just last month, which was the first one since 2018. And it's looking like there could be double that coming up in the week ahead, Jim, by much of the signaling going on. And why is this? Well, any of a host of issues that we've talked about numerously on this podcast, but we can start with the pandemic. There were some notable fiscal policy responses to that. Three big stimuluses, two in the Trump presidency, one under Biden, but not commensurate sort of reining in of the Fed's easy money policies, so to speak. And on top of that, you had, you know, the advent of supply chain problems. You had then the Ukraine war and the energy shocks and so forth. And you have a whole bunch of complex issues coming together that are emphatically showing that inflation is an issue and is something that the country is going to be grappling with in a way it hasn't, it looks like, for 40 years or so. So it's looking like this major policy tool that the Fed has, raising interest rates, is very much on the table. There is a great deal of concern, of course, that moving too aggressively invites or ushers in a recession, which is something that obviously policymakers want to be wary about. Certainly political pressure, you know, mitigates against that. But by the same token, inflation is one of these lurking, scary concepts that I think are sort of focusing attention right now.
Well, Bob, you mentioned both the I word inflation and the R word recession. And one of the things that could naturally happen from jacking up interest rates is to slow down the economy and potentially push it into a recession. And just this morning, it was announced that the U.S. economy actually contracted in the first three quarters of the fiscal year, falling by 1.4%. Now, of course, technically, a recession is two consecutive quarters of downward movement. But how do you think today's news is going to affect the Fed as it considers whether or not to jack up interest rates?
Well, that's an excellent question, Jim. It is that among those balance of factors that they have to take into account, and it's one of the things that I'm sure the Fed's going to hear about, you know, with rising crescendo going into next week's meetings. But the reporting, I'm still going to be interested in looking further at and sort of reading in between the lines of some of the reporting from today's slowdown figures in terms of what things might be hidden in there. There have also been signs that there are still some very, you know, there's resilient aspects to the U.S. economy. There's high levels of employment and so forth. So there are other things going on that could make it not your typical kind of anticipated recession, let's say. But the R word is obviously looming as a very big deal. I should also point out, you know, a number of people have said, look, there's all sorts of things you can say about how the Fed was slow or how it reacted or how it has sought to react to the current environment. Some people have made the point or sought to make the point that the Fed was fighting the last war, meaning it was still dealing with concerns about what happened the last time there was a recession after the so-called Great Recession. And there was, as people will recall, vigorous Fed moves to ease monetary access, and quantitative easing became this a well-known term. And I think being wedded to that has served up a great big lesson perhaps to some policymakers about, or to some Fed and Fed watchers about what should be done now, Jim. So glad I'm not sitting in their seats right now, but it is incredibly complex set of issues to weigh.
Oh, it certainly is. And the medicine needed to tame inflation could be very painful and actually make the patient sicker. I mean, I'm old enough to remember what happened in the late 1970s, where inflation was high, unemployment growth was static. stagnant. And what happened was that cycle got broken only when Paul Volcker, the then Fed chair, jacked up interest rates, sent the country into a very deep recession.
Double-digit interest rates, Jim. I'm not sure people can even fathom that.
It was a painful time, and the economy bounced back. But again, to get to the morning in America, as Ronald Reagan put it when he ran for re-election in 1984, he had to go through some very dark times in 1981, 1982, and clearly Chairman Paul would like to avoid that. It's not clear he will be able to. I should note that, you know, currently, even with the rise in interest rates we've seen recently, interest rates are still incredibly low compared to where they were, as you point out, in late 1970s, in the early 1980s when they were double digits. So they could go up quite a lot more. But obviously, as you go from a lower interest rate environment to a higher interest rate environment, not necessarily a high interest rate environment, that is still a shock to the economic system. And for people who own bonds, and many people own bonds as part of their retirement portfolio, they have taken a very big hit. I mean, the bond market has been going through a rout since the beginning of the year, the worst in 40 years, again, back to when Paul Volcker came in and basically took the punch bowl away from the party and turned the lights off. And again, the criticism of Chairman Powell is that he waited too long to take the punch bowl away from the party. That's going to have domestic political impact, and we'll see how all of this shakes out and whether we can avoid sort of going back to the 1980s experience. But it's also going to have a ripple effect well beyond America's borders, because as we raise our interest rates, that is going to lead to interest rate increases for others, but it's also going to, for people who have borrowed money from the United States, likely raise their interest rates. We've talked about the debt burden or the debt bomb in the third world. And again, that problem in isolation might be something that could be handled or grappled with relatively easily. But when you add to it issues of the war in Ukraine, global disruptions of supply chains because of Ukraine and because of COVID, this could become a bigger global issue, and you could actually end up in a sort of a negatively reinforcing cycle of a lot of bad things, making other bad things worse.
No, those are all really good points, Jim. I mean, the U.S. Federal Reserve is the world's most important central bank. What it does has ripple effects worldwide, really. It should be noted, I believe, that the inflation figures in the U.S. are higher than other major economies, although Europe is dealing with inflation issues as well, certainly on the energy front. And maybe that is a central cause that we could point to as it pertains to Europe. But as it pertains to policy and politics, you know, this was, you know, we should recall, looking back to last summer, after we had already had multiple stimulus moves by the government, there was then the move to the Build Back Better campaign, and the Biden administration was really high on this. It is all but snuffed out. There might be various aspects here and there that trickle through for debate, but a combination of things, not just inflation concerns, but now inflation concerns can, you know, be the final sort of wrap on any ambitious plans by the Biden administration to come up with some, you know, bold fiscal policy. Those other stimulus campaigns before Build Back Better even was proposed had increased the debt ratio in the U.S. tremendously, which, again, it should be noted that when President Trump was in office, Republicans weren't concerned as they had been in the past about debt. Now they're concerned again. And you're looking at a midterm election in which Republicans could gain control of both congressional chambers. And the Fed is supposed to be this independent technocratic institution, but certainly it's been buffeted through the years by politics, and it's going to just be another one of the pressures it deals with.
Well, the Democrats are looking at having a very rough midterm elections. That was always going to be the case. Again, midterm elections, the party holding the White House generally fares poorly at the midterm elections, and it fares really poorly when the economy is suffering. So Democrats have good reason to be concerned. But the flip side of that, of course, is should the conventional wisdom play out and Republicans take back control of the House or the House and the Senate, they will then become responsible for trying to address these issues. And it's not obvious that there is a consensus among Republicans about how to attack these issues. I mean, right now, Republicans have been doing what parties out of power do, spending all their time talking about how the incumbent party is getting things wrong. But once you take the gavel and now control the majority, then your fingerprints are on government action and you have to find ways to make it work. So we could actually be seeing, as a result of this turmoil, even more political turmoil politically after November. I know it may be hard for people to imagine that we could have a domestic politics that is more partisan and more poisonous than it is right now, but I suspect that we have not yet seen how much bickering the two parties can produce.
Yeah, it's may just be a little dress rehearsal, Jim, but it's another time for one of these massive civic lessons for the country in terms of how pricing and monetary policy works, perhaps, but it's going to get lost in some of the political noise, I think, too. Jim, let's turn our attention to the UN Security Council. In the coming week, the United States will assume the rotating presidency of the Security Council, which is the most, let's say, potent chamber in the United Nations. U.S. is one of the five veto-wielding powers as well. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has indicated that the U.S. will use the presidency to focus on the global food crisis, but will also call attention to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and aggression there. So, Jim, can you talk a little bit about what this presidency of the UN Security Council might mean for the agenda in the month of May?
Happy to do so, Bob. The United States on May 1st will take over the UN Security Council presidency from the United Kingdom and hold it for the entire month of May. The rule at the UN Security Council is that the presidency of the Security Council rotates from member country to member country on a monthly basis. What that means when you are president is that you get to set the priorities and the agenda for the month that you hold the presidency. And also, you get to be the spokesperson for the UN Security Council and any official communications to the rest of the world. As you note, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has signaled that the United States is going to focus its presidency on the issue of food security. This has actually been a bit of a theme for the Biden administration at the Security Council. The administration used its presidency last year to highlight conflict-driven hunger. And there's certainly going to be a lot to discuss. The World Food Program, which annoyingly spells its name with two M's and an E, sorry, pet peeve, estimates that 47 million more people in 81 countries will experience acute hunger in 2022 because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. On top of that, almost half the people in Ukraine are now food insecure. You can expect an awful lot of finger pointing to be going on over the course of the month of May. The United States blames Russia for contributing to the current food crisis. Russia retorts that the problem isn't Russian actions, it's Western sanctions. Now, to put things in perspective, Ukraine and Russia supply about 30% of global wheat and barley supplies, a fifth of the world's corn, and over half of its sunflower oil. And to put things in perspective, global food prices in March were 34% higher than last year. So this is an inflationary impact that extends worldwide. More broadly, you can expect that Moscow will complain that the United States is using its presidency to unfairly malign the Kremlin. For example, Russia complained this month under the British presidency that London was using the presidency to block the Russian request to meet to discuss Ukrainian atrocities in Bucha. No, I'm not making that up, even though all the evidence is that Russian troops committed atrocities against Ukrainian soldiers and civilians. The Kremlin argued that those attacks were actually undertaken by the Ukrainians. And likewise, Moscow complained that the United Kingdom allowed President Zelensky to broadcast a video of Russian atrocities to the council. Now, one thing to flag for you, Bob, is that a discussion of food security is not a freebie for the Biden administration. Afghanistan now has the highest number of people facing emergency food insecurity in the world. More than 23 million Afghans are in need of assistance. And because of that fact, you can expect a number of experts, activists, and advocates to argue that the Biden administration needs to end its freeze on Afghanistan's foreign assets. In essence, the U.S. policy of isolating and penalizing the Taliban is immiserating the people of Afghanistan. And if you're wondering, Bob, when Russia gets its turn in the presidency, well, it actually had it back in February. Albania is the country up next. China assumes the presidency in August, and we'll see what Beijing decides to do with its turn, setting the agenda and the priorities.
Yeah, that Russian presidency was sort of theater of the absurd in some ways. I recall the sessions, the late night sessions, as the invasion was playing out, an invasion that the Russians had been saying for days from the UN and any other pulpit it was speaking from was fiction and was never going to happen. In fact, did happen. It pointed out both the absurdity of what the Security Council has become and the sort of ineffectiveness, but also the fact that at the end of the day, a lot of these conversations have to come back to the UN because it's the world's only universal organization. You know, the track record in places like Syria is pretty grim in terms of getting any galvanized Security Council action, even on humanitarian front. But by the same token, I think picking food security is a good area to focus on. It is really important that they make even some baseline movements in that regard in terms of galvanizing actions that can make the delivery of food to Ukraine and broader more effective. We just had a piece go up on our website about the Middle East, the disproportionate impact on the Middle East of the food crisis because of their reliance on Russian-Ukrainian grains and associated products. And, you know, that's the type of stuff that can change governments there and you know, create societal upheaval, to say the least. And so it's another, yet another test for this main security body of the UN to see whether it can actually step up and do something meaningful.
Well, Bob, you mentioned the fact that the United States is one of five veto-wielding members of the UN Security Council, and the existence of the veto is one of the reasons why the Security Council has never lived up to the expectations that its founders had of it when they dreamed up the UN back in the 1940s as an international organization that would help keep the peace and prevent conflict. I'll just note that earlier this month, the United States co-sponsored resolution from Liechtenstein that would automatically send to the General Assembly for debate within 10 days any resolution that was vetoed at the UN Security Council. Now, Liechtenstein had proposed this 2 years ago. The Trump administration wasn't interested in it. I don't get a sense that the Biden administration was terribly interested in the proposal until after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And obviously, Russia is using its position as a veto-wielding member to prevent any Security Council action, even rhetorical, on the issue of what's happening in Ukraine. So if this resolution were ever to pass, if a country wielded its veto, then the UN General Assembly could get to debate it. And I'll just note that, of course, if that were ever to be the case, and it's not the case so far, the United States would also have to live by this rule. And since 2000, the United States has vetoed 27 resolutions, the United States 14, and the Chinese 13. Of course, sending a Security Council resolution to the General Assembly and forcing the veto-wielding member to defend its decision isn't going to take away the veto. Might create some inconvenience, but certainly isn't going to change the basic structure or operation of the UN.
Yeah, and that there have been other reform calls from many different sides that have tried to target the veto as sort of the central problem with the Security Council. And as you indicate, Jim, most of them, if not all of them, are going nowhere because countries who have that right just are not going to give up on the right. Or there must be some trade-off that be truly compelling to let them do that. And we're not in that place right now.
No, we're not. And obviously, countries, given the size of their economy, the size of their population, you would think should be veto-wielding members if you're going to have such a category of countries. I'm thinking, obviously, of India. Think of Brazil. One can make a case for Japan, given the importance of its economy. But any effort to get UN Security Council reform is almost certainly dead even before it starts, because those who have the power don't want to give it up, and those who want the power can't get it.
True enough.
Speaking of Japan, Bob, let's talk a bit more about Tokyo and Japanese politics. On Wednesday, the ruling Liberal Democratic Party submitted to the government its proposal for revising Japan's most important defense and diplomacy documents. The proposal included potentially revising Japan's national security strategy, a move that could signal transformational changes ahead for the island nation's defense and security policies. Tell us more, Bob.
Certainly, Jim. This is occurring in a week in which Japan is marking the 75th anniversary of its constitution, its post-war constitution, a crucial document, really, that has led to the remarkable success story of Japan, basically risen from the ashes of defeat from its totalitarian power in World War II, to become a leading democracy, to become a leading economy, and really foremost in preaching pacifism. But we've been noting for years how the Japanese leaders, especially leaders of the LDP, have been trying to move the country in the direction of reinterpreting the constitution to allow for more flexibility on the defense front, to be able to deploy forces in certain ways that they see are now necessary, given the way the neighborhood is changing, certainly. On top of that, the neighborhood being North Korea testing missiles, including sending some missile tests over Japanese territory, you know, China's assertiveness in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and also as evidenced in what we've now seen playing out in Ukraine and the remarkable Japanese response to that. And remarkable in that the Japanese have come out with, in terms of statements, condemning the move in terms of sanctions, in terms of ousting diplomats, Russian diplomats, and so forth, in ways and with a speed that we just haven't seen before from Japan, and has reflected in the national conversation taking place about the aggression they're seeing in Ukraine, concerns about that type of aggression occurring on their own soil, in their own neighborhood, and the ongoing sort of rethinking of what it will mean to change Japan's defense policy. It's a debate that's still in early phases, I guess I would say, Jim, but it seems to be moving in a direction of bolstering defense policy, bolstering its ability to project a defensive posture. And so this review of the national security strategy is a really important step. We should note that our colleague Sheila Smith has written a great deal about the Japanese constitution and what its changes could mean. To quote the constitution, Japan has been, quote, determined to preserve our security and existence, trusting in the justice and faith of the peace-loving peoples of the world. That notion has really faced a lot of tests in recent years. And again, I think the Ukraine saga playing out right now is really putting it to the test in ways that, you know, we're going to see playing out starting next week again.
Bob, I would echo your plug for Sheila Smith. People can find her expert bio page on CFR.org. She has written an awful lot on this topic, and she actually has an interactive that explores the whole debate over revising the Japanese constitution. And I think it's really important to flag that this is a very big political issue in Japan. It splits the country, I think, to a significant degree, because for many Japanese, Article 9 of the Constitution is core to their understanding of Japan as a democratic, peace-loving nation. Maybe you could talk a little bit more, Bob, just about the divisions within Japan and why Article 9 has so many defenders.
Yeah, I mean, again, as you say, it's a sense of the country's own place in the world and how the Japanese see themselves. And as a country also that suffered, it remains the only country that has suffered nuclear attacks in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This has driven a multiple generational debate and sentiment in the country towards trying to avoid the militarization that got Japan into those circumstances, into the tragedy, and into what it inflicted on other countries in the first place. And so at the same time, it does run up against this ongoing sense in the region that things are getting much more hostile, that, you know, North Korea's missile tests and nuclear tests, which we heard more about this week, Kim Jong-un, you know, coming out with some of his strongest statements yet about the country asserting its right to test nuclear weapons, for example. You know, but also Russia. You know, Russia and Japan had these talks going on, these painstaking talks over the territorial rights of these four islands that are known as the Northern Territories in Japan and the Kuril Islands in Russian. Those are now off the table for one thing. But also Russia's, you know, in the neighborhood as well. Russia, you know, there's concern about a Russian projection of power as well. So it's that balance, Jim, of this sense, the pacifist sense embedded into the country's psyche with a more, let's say, realist sense that things have changed now. And, you know, another change I should note in response to what happened in Ukraine, Jim, is Japan coming up with, first of all, public sentiment strongly in favor of taking in Ukrainian refugees. And then, you know, policies following in suit with including a foreign minister who had recently traveled to Poland, came back with a party of refugees. These are things that are very different for Japan. This is a big change, a real sort of sea change for Japan. And so I think, again, it does remain in some ways early stages of the sort of reconsidering, reinterpreting the constitution in this fashion, but it is moving in that direction and the direction that Shinzo Abe was moving the country in.
And of course, the flip side of that is many of the people who argue for revoking, revising Article 9 of the Constitution argue that it prevents Japan from being, quote, a normal nation. And for many Japanese nationalists, they argue that it's a provision of the Constitution that was forced upon them by the United States and that Japan needs to take back control of its own destiny. One thing I will notice, even though Article 9 has been in place and there's been this limit in Japan and how much can be spent on the military, the Japanese have highly effective, very well-trained, and very well-equipped military forces known as self-defense forces. And in particular, from everything I have heard from people who study this issue much more deeply than I do, the Japanese, when it comes to naval abilities, are quite good and have significant skill.
It's a really good point, Jim. The only other thing I would add to that is there are some, not exactly the same, but similar debates that have been playing out in Germany, much closer, obviously, to the scene of action in Ukraine. But, you know, initially, there was a great deal of concern and derision from some quarters that Germany was only willing to send, you know, a shipment of helmets, over to Ukraine. And then came the invasion and Germany changed. Although in terms of what it was promising, what it was budgeting for, it's now on track to step up to the committed 2% of spending on defense under the NATO commitment that it had agreed to. That's on track maybe for next year. But by the same token, you're still seeing reluctance to fully engage in some of the more robust, you know, defense support that its allies in NATO are already stepping up to provide. So these are legacies of World War II. These are the defeated, you know, aggressive fascist countries that rose as robust democracies in great part because they were initially cowed into it, but also took their opportunity to rebuild societies focusing on democracy and market economies and so forth.
It's a good point, Bob, to raise Germany Germany in the context of this discussion of Japan, because Germany does not have a similar constitutional prohibition on having a military force. And Germany differs in Japan in another way, which is Germany, unlike Japan, has allowed its military forces to become hollowed out. I mean, there's been a longstanding criticism of Germany from other NATO members that the Germans have woefully underinvested in their military. Lots of stories about NATO exercises in which the German forces show up and have to use broomsticks to substitute for real weapons because they aren't sufficiently equipped. And even now, with the talk of coming to the aid of Ukraine, it turned out that some 100 German tanks that might have been given to Ukraine had simply been allowed to deteriorate and were in no shape to be used on a battlefield. And again, that's the big difference here. In the wake of February 24th, the German government has committed a big amount of money to addressing those shortfalls. That's going to take a while to work itself out. I mean, you can allocate money, but it takes time to build weapons and to train your troops on them. And there is this question of whether or not this newfound embrace of a stronger defense policy is going to last. I do think it does have a very good chance of surviving, because if there has been any criticism within Germany about what the government led by Olaf Scholz has done, it has been that they're not acting fast enough. The political criticism hasn't been they're going too far.
No, that's a really good point, Jim. Well, you know what? We've been throwing around a lot of figures, and we've talked our way into the audience figure of the week segment of the podcast. This is a figure that listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. We had a Twitter poll this week. The audience selected, unsurprisingly, I guess, Musk buys Twitter for $44 billion. Jim, why is that significant?
Well, Bob, first off, it seems to be an appropriate choice since we did the poll on Twitter. And Elon Musk has ponied up $44 billion to buy Twitter. Now, he doesn't actually own it right now. It has to go through shareholder approval and regulatory review. And I assume that Musk and his financial supporters will go through Twitter's books and can have the option at a penalty to leave the deal if they see something they don't like. And all of that will probably take 3 to 6 months. But I guess we're going to have this conversation on the assumption that the deal is going to go through. And there's really sort of two things. One, why is Musk, the world's richest man, spending $44 billion to buy Twitter? After all, he already has SpaceX and he has Tesla to keep him busy. And the question is, what's the reaction to Elon Musk making this offer? Now, I'll say that Musk has said that he's not buying Twitter for financial or economic reasons. He's buying Twitter because he wants to preserve free speech and to promote, let me quote him here, a public platform that is maximally trusted and broadly inclusive. Now, he has argued over the past several years that Twitter censors its users. He's complained about the algorithms that Twitter uses, things like that. And what he says he's going to do, at least in broad terms, no specifics yet, is that he is going to revamp the platform's moderation guidelines. He's going to open source its moderation and suggestion algorithms, and he's going to get rid of spam bots. Now, I have to say, anyone who uses Twitter will be delighted if they can make spam bots go away. Now, the announcement that Musk is going to buy Twitter has gotten a lot of applause on the right side of the American political spectrum. I think many conservatives, many people right of center, believe and have long argued that Twitter is hostile to their views, that Twitter's moderation policies have been applied disproportionately to silence them. And of course, the most famous case being the removal of Donald Trump from the platform back in 2021, January of 2021. Now, that leads to the question of whether former President Trump is going to go back on Twitter. He says no, because Twitter is boring and not for him. And of course, he's been involved in trying to create a startup that would compete with, and presumably, if everything went well in his view, supplant Twitter as this sort of public platform for discussion. Now, on the left, there's been a lot of criticism of Musk's decision to purchase Twitter. Some of the criticism reflects concerns about one person owning one of the major social media platforms and how that could be used to squelch free and open discussion or steer the conversation in certain ways. And for others, it reflects concerns that Musk is going to abandon moderation policies, that he's going to allow trolls and hate speech and bullying to run rampant on Twitter. And of course, whenever we talk about Twitter, we have to keep in mind that Twitter itself is not a major economic force. The company's user base and market value is less than 1/10 of Meta, which is the new name for Facebook's parent company. Twitter has just 217 million daily active users. And if you had bought Twitter on the day of its IPO 8 years ago, you would have been underwater before this latest round of bidding that Musk launched. I mean, the real issue is who uses Twitter, and it's obvious it's highly influential politicians, business leaders, activists, think tank people, and they shape the public discourse. So there's big questions about what this is going to mean for the public conversation.
Yeah, and I think it's really surprising with that, with all those users you mentioned, Jim, that it has not been able to be monetized in any meaningful way, given that it's like essential as a forum for people to trade ideas. Threads are now a real thing that people kind of explore ideas and so forth. And yet, you know, and it maybe, and Musk has some ideas that that'll open that up, but it's defied the monetization so far.
Oh, it certainly has. And again, Musk has stressed that he's not doing this because he expects to make a big profit on it. It's not clear whether he's willing to tolerate huge losses either, and how will that play out. There's also one thing that I think it's lost in a lot of the conversation here about Twitter, which is that Twitter is not just a social media platform in the United States. It's a social media platform elsewhere in the world. And here, the difference between America's First Amendment culture and what exists elsewhere becomes really important. Again, under the First Amendment, people have great freedom to say things, even things that are not true. That principle is not the principle that guides most other countries in the world, even our fellow well-established democracies. And so Twitter is going to have some real challenges making sure it negotiates the various strictures from country to country. The EU just passed a new social media digital policy bill, which could affect the way Twitter operates in the European Union. And so you can see significant differences from one place to another. Because in essence, what Musk has said is that he wants Twitter to only have those restrictions on speech that are required by government law. But that, of course, means that if governments have different laws, and they do, particularly when you leave democracies and get to autocracies, which are pretty quick to shut down Twitter and things like it when it harms their interests. And of course, China doesn't allow Twitter at all, as I understand it.
Yeah, really good point on the international use of Twitter, Jim, and you know, what are European regulations going to mean for Twitter and other major social platforms owned by U.S. firms in particular? All fascinating stuff about to play out.
I have to wonder if the whole idea of be careful what you wish for may come into play here. Musk has admitted that owning Twitter could be a headache. Indeed, just before he made the offer to buy it, he said that owning Twitter would be a recipe for misery, and that as the new owner, everyone will blame me for everything. So at least he can't say he doesn't know what he was getting himself into.
And let's see if he actually fully does get into this. We'll be watching closely. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Countries around the world mark May Day. Vietnam marks Liberation Day. And Muslims around the world celebrate Eid.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by the one and only Zoe Collis, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. As always, Zoe, thank you very much. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be careful out there.